Connor, are you with us?
I am, Jay. How's it going?
I am doing super. Okay, so I've been thinking about this all morning, and I'm trying to think of exceptions to the rule. And, you know, look, if Immanuel Kant can't come up with exceptions to the Golden Rule, you've certainly stumbled onto something here. So please, and I hope everybody turns up their radio nice and loud, what are the exceptions to the Golden Rule?
Well, before I list them, you know, I think after last night's debate, we learned that there are a list, right? Because we had Ron Paul that was booed on stage for suggesting that our foreign policy should be based on the application of the Golden Rule. So I thought, you know, these people are smart. They've taken time out of their day to sit here and to, you know, review the different positions of the presidents and to collectively and boisterously boo a man who suggests that. There ought to be some exception to
that. Yeah, hold on. Let me play that clip real quick. I got
sure.
It queued up here. Hold on just a second.
Seconds to respond, since you were mentioned.
My point is if another country does to us what we do others, we're not going to like it very much. So I would say that maybe we ought to consider a golden rule in foreign policy. Don't do to other nations what we don't want to have them do to us. So we endlessly...
I mean, it boggles my mind. Okay. Okay, I'm sorry. I just thought that was relevant to play.
Well, right, and these people can't be dumb. So I took some time, and I sat down, and I said, okay, you know, golden rule, it's just a principle. You know, it's just a basic rule of thumb, basic ethical moral code. There's got to be some exceptions, you know. So without further ado, I present right now the list of exceptions to the golden rule. Here we go.
Okay.
All right, I'm not going to read them. Here we go. Okay, I'm done.
There are none.
No, it was a short list. I mean, you know, I had to think really hard to figure out what exceptions there are. And I'm sorry to say for all the people who booed down Ron Paul's suggestion last night, but there are no exceptions, right? And let's be clear first real quick of what the Golden Rule is. This isn't just a Christian thing, though Jesus's counsel on the topic is by far the most widely known where he basically says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But, you know, I had a few quotes here. This goes throughout time. Confucius said, never impose on others what you would not choose for yourself. In ancient Egypt, you know, they said, that which you hate to be done to you, do not do to another. Ancient Greece, they said, do not do to others what would anger you if done to you by others. And so this is a pervasive, universal law. It's not just a Christian thing. Any religion has the fundamental... you know, principle behind what we consider the Golden Rule today. There are no exceptions. There are no footnotes that were added throughout the, you know, when ancient Egypt, they were writing on their papyrus, they didn't include a little footnote there and say, well, actually, in these circumstances, this rule doesn't apply. And Jesus didn't take his disciples aside afterwards and say, well, that was kind of the general rule that we need to follow. Here are some exceptions. There are none, right? If this applies to you and I and people on an interpersonal, individual level, why would it not apply on a universal level, a national level, between governments, which are just, you know, organizations of people? This was a rule that was meant to govern the conduct of men. And even when those men organize into governments, even when those governments don't like one another, that does not mean that there is an exception to that rule, despite what the boos last night would suggest. I think those boos speak more poorly about us as individuals, or if we can just put it directly on that audience, I suppose, that we think, you know, generally that this rule is just so simplistic, so antiquated, it just doesn't work in a day and age when, you know, we have 9/11 happening and we have terrorists who are willing to kill themselves, and it's just boggling, like you said, mind-boggling that people want to completely discard what is a universal rule, a very Christian rule, especially in South Carolina, where they're predominantly, you know, evangelical Christian, that they have no even consideration for the idea that this golden rule, to which they might profess importance on Sunday, has application on the rest of the days of the week, especially when we're talking about those who would do us harm.
Yeah, I mean, it's mind-boggling to me. It really is mind-boggling to me. And it just tells me that, again, because I know that it was co-sponsored by Tea Party Express, they had to have stacked it, that audience, with their selected neoconservative warmongering morons, because I refuse to believe all the people in South Carolina. The thing that was so telling to me, and I do applaud CNN for at least doing this in their post debate analysis or whatever you call it, or their spin room, however, you know, whatever you want to call it. They did show the results on Twitter, how many people on Twitter responded favorably to all the different candidates across topics and whatever. Ron Paul killed everybody, as usual, right, as he does on the internet, but at least they showed that it wasn't. I have to say that I don't think it was CNN so much trying to do the social engineering, because they did offer that.
I think it was Fox, right? I think Fox did that.
Oh, maybe you're right. It was Fox. I don't think it was. You're right. It was Fox. I don't think it was Fox who was trying to do the social engineering as much as it was Tea Party Express.
Sure,
I have a feeling they stacked it.
Well, and I don't even know that it required much engineering. That there exist people like this at all. You know, like even if they try to gather people who just kind of generally think this way, they lean more neoconservative. It's troubling that those people even exist at all. Not that they would try and stack the deck and have those people represented more, but that you would find anyone like that who would just outright boo the suggestion that our foreign policy should be based on a universal moral principle is very disconcerting. There's a verse in the Bible where Jesus says, in the Beatitudes, and Jesus says, "Blessed are the peacemakers," right? He's basically encouraging and counseling that we should sue for peace. It pervades other scriptures as well. Blessed are the peacemakers.
So Jesus is saying, blessed are the peacemakers, and then goes after the money changers. That's Ron Paul.
Well, what I was thinking last night is that I think the neocons must have a new translation of the Bible or something where they flipped it and it says, blessed are the warmongers, because people feel like, you know, the only man up there on stage last night that was trying to sue for peace, that was trying to promote peace, was Ron Paul. Everyone else was just this nasty, frothing at the mouth warmonger who was clamoring for war. They were each trying to outdo one another in slamming Ron Paul on the suggestion that, that blowback exists and that our foreign policy of intervention has provoked people to come over here and attack us. They were trying to outdo one another. Mitt Romney was saying, oh, Osama got a bull in his head and that's exactly what we need. And, you know, they were just, it was disgusting. And so I do think that they've completely rejected collectively this council to promote peace. And now it's just all out war. We've thrown our principles to the wind, even if we claim to adhere to them once upon a time. I'm especially saddened because Mitt Romney is a member of my same faith. And our same faith says repeatedly in our scriptures, as it does in the Bible generally, to renounce war, to proclaim peace, that even when enemies attack, we're supposed to promote peace. And I don't see a single suggestion coming from Mitt Romney's lips that he wants anything having to do with peace. It's more than the size of Guantanamo. It's sending more troops over. It's spending more.
Yeah, I would sign NDAA and all that kind of stuff. I mean,
right.
We're actually bumping up on our commercial break here in about 30 seconds, but I want to go deeper into that a little bit, because I think that people, this is what I really like about your book, about your passions here for Utah and the liberty movement in Utah, because I want you to show or explain scripture-wise why Mitt Romney is the anti-Mormon candidate, that he's actually, despite calling himself that, that he's actually going against the principles of the scripture. Come on back, guys. Middle of the Boyack Review with Connor Boyack. Talking about the Golden Rule. All right, guys, welcome back. Mental Self Defense Radio. We're in the middle of the Boyack Review. We've got Connor Boyack. I am curious how on earth anybody who's serious about their faith in the LDS Church could really look at Mitt Romney. And I am not a scholar by any means. We do have somebody who is deep into both liberty and the Mormon scriptures with us here in Connor Boyack. I'm always thrilled to have you. Connor, please explain to me Mitt Romney. It doesn't even seem to make sense. It's like matter and antimatter. It should like totally disappear.
I don't know if they're reconcilable. I don't know if I can explain it. You asked for a few scriptures, and I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, but there are some that kind of articulate the points that we're talking about. Of course, we're talking about here the Golden Rule, you know, stems at least in the Christian faith from the Bible. In Matthew chapter 7, you know, all things whatsoever you would do that men should do unto you, do even so unto them. So that's, you know, the Golden Rule, the application that he's violating. The Book of Mormon, another scripture of our faith, repeatedly talks about the perils of preventive war, that we should not go up and fight other people in their lands, that if we position ourselves defensively, that we will merit God's protection, and that we will be more righteous and just if we, rather than going on the offensive, if we go on the defensive. It's a theme that pervades many of the stories and the experiences that's related in the Book of Mormon.
And this is a real defense, not this fake, get us into World War II, Pearl Harbor, let them attack us, or false flag attack.
Correct.
In the,
it's a very non-interventionist, mind your own business, you know, treat other, basically the golden rule, you know, but if you are attacked, then there is a legitimate opportunity to repel the threat, not to go and try and, you know, retaliate and seek revenge or anything like that, but just to deter the threat and, you know, let them kind of go back to whatever they were doing before. You don't follow them to their own country and occupy their land and bomb their, you know, homes and put sanctions on them and all this stuff that we do. It's very much, you know, in my book, Latter-day Liberty, I talk about this for a full chapter about war and what, in my view, from my understanding of the scriptures, that how God justifies war. And not that we have war, therefore, how is God going to justify it? By that I mean how we make war justifiable. In what sense can it be justifiably waged?
Now let me ask you something, Connor. Mm-hmm. This is something that I wonder, too, about the compatibility of the LDS faith and libertarianism seems apparent to me, and yet practice, how people actually practice the faith seems not libertarian. Explain to me the Lamanites, right? Isn't that like a race of brown-skinned people, maybe from Mexico or South America or something?
What happened was the Book of Mormon tells the story of a people who were Semitic in their ethnic background. They left Jerusalem.
You don't necessarily mean Jewish. You mean it could be Arab, whatever, Semitic.
They were Jewish. They,
oh, okay.
So they fled to America and migrated here. And the Lamanites were a division of that family. So basically the children had some contention, and there were two factions that split from that migrating family. And so the Book of Mormon says that they were dark-skinned. Some have over time interpreted that to mean that they were brown and, you know, that a mark was placed upon their skin. Others have disagreed with that interpretation. But from a principle or ideological standpoint, these two factions split and were continually at war with one another. And the Nephites were kind of the more righteous ones. They had the gospel of Jesus Christ, and they were keeping the commandments, whereas the Lamanites fell into wickedness and were sinning and were rebellious against the commandments of God. And so the Nephites had specific counsel for what they should do in terms of defending themselves from the attacks. Now, in the Book of Mormon, it says that when the Nephites became wicked, then the Lamanites would come and attack them, and that by the wicked would be attacked and destroyed.
But isn't there something to where the Lamanites end up being the chosen people? I hate to fast forward on you, but isn't that in there or something, or am I wrong?
No, you are right. Yeah, later on, the Nephites became more and more depraved. They were disobeying God. They were becoming a vicious people, a vengeful people. They were disregarding some of these principles that we're talking about. They became a very warlike people, whereas the Lamanites, who historically were that way, became a much more pacifist, peace-loving people. They embraced the gospel. Of course, this is many generations down, right? So this is their descendants, and they embraced the gospel of Jesus Christ. They begin to live it like the Nephites historically did, and for a while you have this flip where the Nephites, who were historically good, were now bad, and then the Lamanites, who were historically bad, were now good, and it's, you see that here are these principles, here are these commandments. Whoever obeys them is going to merit, you know, the blessings of God, his protection. And you see that follow two different courses in that the Nephites start obeying at first. They later disregard it. And then the Lamanites disregard it at first, and then they later obey it. I think it's good counsel for us, whether you're Mormon or not, that here are these principles that when followed, they are the right course to take. That it's not so much who you are, what religion you are, what background you come from, but there are observable, even you might call them natural law principles that we can observe. You know, it's very libertarian in nature. The golden rule is just, it's what the libertarians call the non-aggression principle. Don't do to other people, you know, don't violate other people's rights unjustifiably unless in defense that they're attempting to justify yours. So with some exceptions, as there might always be in a large book of scripture, I see that that's the general message that's there. In our modern revelation as well, in the Doctrine and Covenants, God gives his commandments, his instructions on what a just war can be in section 98 of the Doctrine and Covenants. He counsels us to renounce war, to proclaim peace. He even goes so far and says that that we can be attacked three times, and each time we should, quote, lift a standard of peace. And that after the third time, if we're continually attacked, if we're attacked once more, then the Lord justifies us in going out to fight our battles, and then he will help fight our battles for us. So you look at, like, 9/11, yeah, we were attacked, but that was only one time by the specific group, if you believe the government's line of, you know, the actors and influences in that cause. But to then go out so, you know, a decade later, spending blood and treasure, occupying countries, throwing out our civil liberties in the process. I mean, I got a laugh, Jake. You've probably seen this meme going around that sometimes you'll see these fun little cartoons that people will do and says, oh, they must hate us for our freedoms, so let's get rid of them. And
right.
In the name of fighting terrorism, we completely eviscerate our individual liberties with this NDA thing that you talked about that Mitt Romney said he would sign that allows for the indefinite detention of an American citizen with no due process, with no trial. It's just ridiculous. And we've so strayed from principles, whether from a Latter-day Saint standpoint, whether from a general Christian standpoint, even from a natural law, you know, common sense standpoint, we have so completely deviated from our core American, classical liberal principles that whether you want to use scripture to justify a return to those principles or simply common sense, I think that's the only thing. And Ron Paul, you know, was the only one on stage that was there proclaiming peace, and he got booed for it. So like you said right before my segment, we clearly, even if Ron Paul were elected, we clearly have a lot of work to do, educational specifically, to get people to understand the proper application of these principles.
Well, that's what I like about doing, because I am not LDS. You know, everybody knows that. But that said, your effort is almost the same thing that I'm trying to do, and that is close this gap between rhetoric and reality, whether that's in politics or whether that's in religion, the moral code by which a lot of people live their lives. I mean, I think this is it, is the disconnect. And I that's what I like about your books, or your book, Latter-day Liberty, is that you're trying to get people to actually live the scripture. That is this idea of non-intervention, of free agency, those kind of things, and how that's congruent with a libertarian philosophy.
Yeah, and we've said before that I feel that the greatest problem that we have in our day politically is inconsistency. That, you know, whether it's on Sunday that we'll, you know, read these scriptures and believe in these principles and talk about how great they are, or whether, you know, domestically we'll support limited government, but then, you know, for foreign policy we don't. I think inconsistency is one of our biggest problems, and that, you know, my effort, your effort, I'm sure, is trying to get people to say, look, you agree with this principle, but now let's look at its fullest application, that it's not limited only to domestic policy or to your individual life. But in this case, for example, with the Golden Rule, it's not just about, you know, treating your spouse like you would want her to treat you. It's not about, you know, treating your boss like you would want him to treat you. Sure, those things are important. That clearly it has application under the Golden Rule. But consistency requires taking that same counsel and applying it to every interpersonal relationship, even indirectly through government. Because again, after all, government is just us. It's just a collection of individuals that, when that government is legitimate, has been authoritatively delegated certain powers that we ourselves inherently possess. Government is just us. And so why, there, you know, like we said at the opening, there are no exceptions to the Golden Rule. Consistency, if we're to actually be consistent in our support of political principle and their application, it requires that we apply it in every case, not just the cases that are comfortable, not just in the cases that are easier to apply it, but in the really hard cases. That is the point of, you know, Christ's teachings. It wasn't easy, you know, although by and large he would say that his yoke is easy, that when you live the commandments, your life is just easier because you're free and you're not shackled down by sin and wickedness. But these things aren't just comfortable teachings. They, you know, so many of Christ's followers left him because of the difficulty of the application of what he was talking about.
Well, and that really is it. What we're talking about, and we both end up, I think, our ends are the same. Maybe our means are a little bit different, but our ends are the same. And that is what you're exactly, you keep using the word application, and that is applied moral philosophy. How do we actually live our ethical code, our moral system, and not just give it lip service? Not just, and that means not just religious, that means Republican. How many Republicans say, I'm small government, and then they go and vote for some crazy huge expenditure that adds to the national debt?
Right. Almost all of them.
And I found this clip here. Here's the Post vote wrap up on the Twitter stuff. The actual this is just shows me how manipulated things are. I think this is relevant.
To be dodging every question in the eyes of people who are tweeting in. Rick Santorum above the line on the economy. The same with Rick Perry. Ron Paul way above the line. Ron Paul always tends to do well in these Twitter surveys. They are not scientific. They are people voting for their favorite candidate. Sometimes and other times they are a good measure of what's being said. Let's move it ahead now to foreign policy and take a look here. Newt Gingrich did very, very well on foreign policy. Mitt Romney, not as far below the line as he was in some of the other topics. Rick Santorum, Rick Perry, and Ron Paul also all did well on foreign policy. Let's take it another.
John,
what they're not showing here is basically Ron Paul is as high up on the rankings as you could possibly get. You could just type this in. Ron Paul dominates Fox's Twitter survey, and it'll come up. But like in that measure, Ron Paul's like way dominating. They're not really, I think, being fair. But you could see it when you look at the charts.
Well, and I think, you know, what Ron Paul talks about is really uncomfortable for a lot of people, right? Speaking truth to power, proclaiming peace amidst just a cacophony of you know, warmongers who are trying to bleed us into the next war and bleed us of more blood and treasure that we can't afford. Ron Paul is the one who's saying things that seem simplistic, right? I mean, it's just, let's apply the golden rule to our foreign policy. But again, when you get into that application, it's not going to be easy. It wouldn't be easy, you know, to encourage Congress to sign on with everything that happens, to get the American people to understand. But more and more people are. I am amazed to see where we're at now versus 4 years ago in terms of just the general liberty movement, whether you're talking about the vehicle of the Ron Paul presidency or all of the other ancillaries that are happening with, you know, think tanks across the nation or people doing their own spontaneous projects to advance the cause of liberty. It's been really amazing how far we've come. And I think it's because people are getting so fed up with the status quo. They're seeing this inconsistency, right? Because you've got, you know, George Bush, who clearly violated the Constitution, violated liberty over and over again with the Bush Doctrine. And then you've got Obama, who rose up from the, you know, obscurity and was criticizing Bush for all these things. And people from a, at least from a civil liberties point of view, were saying, this would be great. You know, I don't agree with all the guys, maybe economic stuff or whatever, but to have someone who's going to close Guantanamo, who's going to bring the troops home, who's going to, you know, restore civil liberty and stop the abuses. And then you see him get into office and take the Bush Doctrine, accelerate it, expound on it, rather than just locking up and throwing away the key for individuals. He was assassinating American citizens now. And now he has the power with the NDAA to indefinitely detain American citizens. I think people see this back and forth, and the more it happens, as bad as that is, it becomes easier for people to wake up and see that they're all wrong, that libertarianism provides the only, even a simplistic, solution to our problem.
Hey, love it, man. Good stuff.